Hello, John Dennis here on Friday, November the 21st. Today, the price of oil dips to less than $50 a barrel. It makes a big interest rate cut in 2 weeks' time even more likely.
But good news for motorists. We're going to see further falls in the price of petrol, and the RSA are talking about petrol prices well below 90p a litre.
Also today, the cut-out-and-keep academic who defaced British Library books.
Mr. Hakimzadeh has fundamentally broken that level of trust which is necessary for us to do what we need to do, that is to give people access to our books.
And the government talks tough on immigration, but what's the reality behind the rhetoric?
Whilst his rhetoric in the first few weeks in his job has had more in common with The Sun and the Daily Mail, it's beginning to translate into a slightly tougher policy as well.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's news and a flick through the papers.
Oil prices have fallen to below $50 a barrel, the lowest for 3 years. The price is now a third of what it was in July. Dealers say the fear of world recession means that less oil will be needed. The same fears meant the US stock market fell heavily again by 5%, but the Asian markets have recovered a small part of this week's heavy losses. The US Congress has postponed a plan to bail out the three biggest car companies with a $25 billion loan. The Speaker of the lower house, Nancy Pelosi, said Congress needed to be convinced that the money would actually save the companies, General Motors, Ford and Chrysler. She said, until they show us a plan, we can't show them the money. The companies said they'd submit a business plan as soon as possible. They told Congress that if they collapse, it would have a major effect on jobs and the economy. The United Nations Security Council has agreed to send another 3,000 troops to help with peacekeeping in the civil war in Congo. Rebels have agreed to pull back from their march on the capital to allow aid workers to reach displaced refugees, but it may take weeks for the extra troops to arrive. The National Intelligence Council of the USA says the world's entering an unpredictable and unstable period. It says that most major powers, including the USA, will steadily lose their ability to influence world events. Over the next 15 years, the report expects the world to become more fragmented, with increasing conflict over resources. We'll have more on this later in Guardian Daily. The Council of Mortgage Lenders will publish the number of people who've lost their homes in the last 3 months. It expects the figure for the whole of 2008 will be over 40,000. The National Association of Estate Agents says that at least 5,000 properties a week are being put on the market because owners can't afford mortgage payments. The pop star Madonna and her English husband, film director Guy Ritchie, are to divorce today. Neither is expected to be in court for the fast-track proceedings at the High Court in London. They have two sons who will split their time between Britain and the United States. The Mirror carries a picture of the couple on its front page, beside a quote from Ritchie, "Oh, thank God." But there's another high-profile divorce on the front pages of The Express and Telegraph. Formula One boss Bernie Eccleston and his wife Slavika are said to be splitting after 24 years of marriage. The Telegraph asks if it'll be the world's most expensive divorce. Other papers go back to the economy. The Times reports the number of people forced out of their homes by mortgage payments. The Mail says that Chancellor Alistair Darling is so exasperated by the way banks are not helping small businesses and families that he'll toughen the law. Banks, now it gets ugly, says the headline. The Guardian says rebellious Labour MPs want Mr. Darling to give more money back to those who lost out when the Chancellor abolished the lowest rate of tax. On the back pages, it's football again that takes the lead. An Arsenal captain, William Gallas, has a picture of him shouting in almost every paper. He's been telling journalists the club's not doing well enough because his teammates lack courage. He tells The Guardian that they are not brave enough in battle. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The price of oil fell to below $50 a barrel yesterday. Earlier this year, some leading oil producers said it could peak at $200 a barrel, but it's now the cheapest it's been for more than 3 years. Our economics editor Larry Elliott explains why.
The price of oil has dropped below $50 a barrel for one simple reason. The global economy is heading for its first synchronised recession in almost 30 years. Demand for oil is going to fall quite sharply as all the major economies in the world start to grow far more slowly. Therefore, they're not going to need as much energy, and therefore demand for oil is falling, and that's pushing down the price. Quite simple, demand and supply.
What will be the effect of the falling price of oil?
Well, good news for motorists here. It will be, we're going to see further falls in the price of petrol, and the RSA are talking about petrol prices well below 90p a litre. You know, if you take the average family saloon, that's probably going to mean the cost of filling up is about 17 quid less than it was back in the summer, which is a considerable saving. I mean, given all the other things which are facing the consumer, that's actually one piece of good news and should help support spending in the rest of the economy. So that's one piece of good news. I mean, it should help also to bring down energy costs for companies, so that will bring down their costs. It will bring down the rate of inflation, which will help the Bank of England to cut interest rates. And with luck, it should also feed through into wholesale prices in the other energy markets, in the gas markets, which should, with a bit of luck, bring down the prices for energy in the home.
Earlier this year, oil prices were over $100 a barrel.
Higher than that, $147.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a rapid decline. Back in June, Gordon Brown had a disagreement with the oil producing nations about the cause of the rising price of oil. He was saying it was being fueled by surging demand rather than speculation. Was he wrong about that?
I think Gordon Brown probably was wrong about that. I mean, an awful lot of that increase in price seemed to me at the time to be totally unjustified by the fundamentals. Now, there are people, and I have some sympathy with them, who say that we're about to reach the point where we have what's known as peak oil, that we're going to start running out of oil, that, you know, we're not going to actually get as much out of the ground as we need to maintain demand at current levels, and that will gradually the supplies will tail off. I mean, I don't think it was that was driving the price, and I don't really think it was totally the fact that the global economy had up until that point been growing very strongly. Though those were two factors, I think, but they weren't the most important factor. The most important factor was that there was massive speculative buying of oil, and hedge funds who'd lost their shirt pretty much on some of the other dodgier assets around the place, you know, the subprime mortgages and all the derivatives from those, were piling into the oil price, and the oil price was going up because it was going up. I mean, you know, it was going up, therefore people were piling into it, therefore it was going up a bit more. And like any other, you know, speculative play, at some point people start to think, well, can we justify this levels? And once the price turned, it came down very quickly as all those speculative trades unwound. So we are now, I think, back to a more credible level for the oil price. I mean, I think it probably got a bit further to go.
Yeah, how far might it go, do you think?
Well, I mean, it slightly depends on how deep the global recession is. I mean, and what the response from OPEC is, but I mean, I would have thought that it will certainly fall below $40 a barrel, and we may even get back to the sort of $30 a barrel level that we had in the early part of this decade, because it's quite clear to me that the global economy is not going to pull out of this recession anytime soon. It's going to be a real stinker, this recession. I mean, you know, you only got to look around the world. I mean, you've got the American car companies on the point of collapse. You've got, you know, Europe already in recession. You've got, you know, consumer spending in the UK under real pressure. I mean, no one's actually selling any cars at the moment anywhere. You know, people are, you know, quite scared about their jobs. They're seeing their house prices fall. I mean, these are not conditions under which you're going to see a rising oil price by any stretch of the imagination. So I think it's entirely possible that the oil price will come down to $40-$30 a barrel. It may well be underpriced at some point in the near future, because that's the way markets work. They go haywire at both ends of the spectrum, and it may well be that the right oil price is $40 or $50 a barrel. But that's not to say it won't fall to $20 or $30 a barrel if the speculation carries on.
Larry Elliott. Well, high street sales fell by 0.1% in October. That's according to the Office for National Statistics. But it's not nearly as bad as the 0.9% many analysts had expected. The British Retail Consortium said yesterday that the figures don't really reflect just how tough conditions are for retailers and consumers. To get a clearer picture, The Guardian's Martin Wainwright spoke to shoppers in Sheffield city centre.
I'm in the middle of Sheffield, outside Marks and Spencer's, where they've got the 20% discount, and I've just found a lady sat on a bench with some bags. You were just telling me you came here to do your Christmas shopping, but you've not been very happy.
No, we've been in a lot of stores that we're normally going. And they have lovely offers usually at Christmas, but they're just not there. The gifts, well, there's only half as much, and there's quality's not there.
Is it quality more than price? I mean, are there some good discounts, or does that not in a way bother you? You're looking more for something special for your family?
Well, prices are expensive as well. The offers that are on, I don't think they're as good as they used to be. and the choice isn't there. There's no Christmas spirit at the moment, and usually we've got it at this time of year.
Just pounced on another lady who's just come out of M&S with two big green bags. Was it the 20% off that attracted you, or were you in Sheffield shopping anyway?
I work in Sheffield City Centre anyway, but I've come up in my lunch hour just to have a look round in.
I don't want to spread gloom, but you know everybody's talking about recession. Is recession built into your Christmas plans? I mean, are you giving maybe slightly fewer presents or not spending quite so much, or has it not got to that?
I think I'm shopping more carefully, and things like this 20% off, 25% off at Debenhams, I think make the effort to go there and get the bargains.
Good. Oh, well, that's exactly what they're hoping people will say. And without intruding on your privacy, what have you got today?
A dressing gown and some of the 3 for 2 gifts. So
oh, that's good.
3 for 2 and 20% off as well. So
3 for 2, gosh, and that's Christmas crackers there.
Yes.
Oh, very good. I've just been approached by a gentleman who's told me the Guardian's a London paper, and I've told him stoutly that it isn't completely. Are you cutting back this Christmas, or are you?
I already have done. That's what I mean, because I'm retired and I'm 75, and like I said, with bits and pieces, it's affecting everybody, isn't it?
Yes.
Like I say, I don't need that much. What I do spend, it's for my grandchildren and my own children.
And have you? Well, that's great, and they always love it. But have you had to reduce this year?
Yes, I have. Everybody has. If they said different, they're lying, I think, because it's everybody. And I get right mad because I wonder where it's all gone to, and will they get money from this and other, but not for certain things.
We're standing outside Marks and Spencer's, which has got this 20% off. So that's like a fifth of the price off. Will that help?
Yeah, my wife loves it in here.
Martin Wainwright reporting. And there's more on the economy today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, 101 things to do over Christmas. The ultimate festive guide to going out, including pantomimes, Christmas markets, carol concerts, ice skating, and the best arts events over December. That's all at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. Why is a contemporary music festival restaging a 50-year-old concert? Christopher Fox celebrates John Cage, Time Bender and Rule Breaker at guardian.co.uk/music. And Martin Kettle hails John Sargent, a champion of the dignified middle-aged. guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say on that. A 60-year-old Iranian businessman, Farhad Hakimzadeh, is being sentenced at Wood Green Magistrates Court today after admitting damaging books at the British Library and at Oxford's Bodleian Library. He cut out pages from the library copies and used them to replace bits of his own editions of the books. About 150 books were believed to have been damaged. The head of collections at British Library, Dr. Christian Jensen, says his staff were devastated.
I mean, I think I can speak on behalf of all my colleagues here at the British Library that we are extremely angry about it. I think it's important to understand that we're not a museum. We're a working library. And in order for us to do what our users need, they basically need to handle our books. That means that there has to be extended a level of trust between them and us. And Mr. Hakimzadeh has fundamentally broken that level of trust, which is necessary for us to do what we need to do, that is to give people access to our books. If we don't give access to them, they're meaningless. So we're very angry about that. And I think I'm also very angry about it because it's an extremely selfish act. These are items which have been in the care of this nation, some of them for several hundred years, and the nation has invested in them over several hundred years in order to give access to them to a wide public. And this has been a public institution since the mid-18th century. So a lot of goodwill and a lot of money has gone into that. And this one selfish person has come along and thought that it was perfectly okay for him to destroy it for his own purposes, not caring about the rest of us.
How did Hakimzadeh go about damaging these books?
Well, he used a variety of techniques, which I don't want to go too much into detail with, but I mean, one of the things he used was some sort of a sharp implement, which he used to excise individual pages, clearly done with tremendous forethought and deceit, because it's not as if you're not, it's a public space, you're under observation in our reading room, so he has chosen his moment and his place very, very carefully. And of course, we have learned lessons from this, and since we've discovered this, we have changed both the physical layout of our reading meeting room, changed some of the furniture to improve sight lines. We've installed much more CCTV, and we have increased, for instance, the number of people who walk around and keeping an eye on things in the reading room as well. And we've done a number of other things which we're sort of keeping slightly more under wraps, because we don't want people to know everything we're doing in the security area.
Did Hakim Zada understand the significance of the items that he was damaging?
I think that's a really important point. He's a specialist in his field. He has published books in this area. The books he has damaged are all relating to, let's say, the wider Middle East, the Mughal Empire, the stretch of land from Syria, let's say roughly, to Bangladesh. And that's an area which he has studied himself in great detail. He runs a charity which is devoted to promoting relationship between Iran and this country, and also supports academic work in that area. He knows what is the intellectual importance of the material he has damaged, which in my view makes it so much worse. He knew the importance of what he was destroying for the rest of us.
Can the stolen pages be recovered?
The police have recovered some of the stolen pages from his flat, and we're now waiting for the sentencing tomorrow, and we have also begun a civil claim against him, where we hope that we might gain more of our material back. So some of the pages we will certainly get back, and some of them we will be able to insert into the books without causing further damage. But even so, once the book has been tampered with in that way, it will permanently, forever, show the result of what has happened. By putting the pages back in, we can bring the books up to as good as one can, but there's no doubt that they will forever show the sign of what is done.
Dr. Christian Jensen from the British Library. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Barack Obama faces a Mad Max future, according to a report from his intelligence advisers.
It depicts a world in which the US is no longer the sole superpower able to call the shots, more or less alone. It says that world is now gone.
But first, a new system of regulating immigration comes into effect next Thursday, and a new immigration and citizenship bill will feature in next month's Queen's Speech. Phil Woolis, the immigration minister, answered questions from MPs yesterday on the Commons Home Affairs Select Committee.
The prime objective of our policy is to provide the reassurance to the public that the immigration system in our country is under control, that we have robust information on the numbers coming in and going out of the country, that we are able to provide reassurance that the population projections of the Office of National Statistics and others, including Right Honourable and Honourable Members of the House, that the population is forecast to reach 70 million, that will not be the case, that the measures that we are putting into place, bearing in mind, of course, Mr. Chairman, as this committee understands fine well, that migration is not the only function or variable in population, of course, but that we have the policy measures, or will have the policy measures, in place to ensure that that population projection does not in fact come about.
Well, Phil Woolis has been talking tough on immigration. Now he says he'll block appeals to High Court judges from failed asylum seekers facing deportation. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
Well, we had a little glimpse of what his rather sterner, tougher rhetoric is going to translate into yesterday's meeting of the Commons Home Affairs Select Committee, where they asked him and Lynn Homer, the head of the border agency, to come and give evidence to them. And he started talking about blocking off judicial review access for people facing failed asylum seekers facing deportation if they have already had their case looked at by senior judges. So we can see that whilst his rhetoric in the first few weeks in his job has had more in common with The Sun and the Daily Mail, it's beginning to translate into a slightly tougher policy as well.
I mean, he has, you mentioned the Sun and the Daily Mail, but he has specifically said that the government wants to get its message across to Sun readers. Is there anything in the government, what the government's planning to do, that might appeal to Guardian readers?
To Guardian readers? Well, that's an interesting question. I think there is, in the new points-based system that's been introduced on the 27th, that's next week, really, which is a bigger shake-up, they say, for 45 years of the immigration system. And I think there is something to that, which is attempting to manage migration. They're trying to essentially, though, diffuse yet again the immigration debate by giving the impression that they can control the flow here. The good news, as far as Guardian readers may be concerned about what's going on in immigration, is that immigration to this country is now beginning to fall quite sharply. And we've seen the numbers coming from Poland. We had figures published yesterday, earlier this week, on migration to Britain, showing that numbers of Poles and other Eastern Europeans coming this last summer was down by a third compared to 2007. And National Insurance registration backed that up. And the number of people coming from Romania and Bulgaria, the latest members to join the EU, are also going down, 9,000 down to 6,000. And in that situation, we had commentators like Danny Sistrunjaja of the IPPR arguing that as economic recession begins to bite, then migration will fall, as it has done in the last three recessions that's come to Britain. So it may be that the political poison in the debate over immigration may simply be such an egg away a bit by the fact that the numbers start to go down. Unfortunately, very few of the media publicise the fact that immigration numbers are going to fall. They look further back at figures from 2007 about net migration. What was different was that fewer people left the country. So we had a record number of 400,000 people going to live principally in places like Australia and Spain in 2007. That was down by about 60,000 on that 400,000 figure to 340,000. So fewer people left the country. Fewer people came in, so net migration overall, the balance between the two, actually went up. And this was reported by most of the media as net immigration going up. And you have all these headlines saying more people coming into the country, but the figures actually showed that fewer people had come. So the debate is somewhere behind what's actually going on in terms of people coming to live here or to leave the country and live elsewhere.
Alan Travis. The National Intelligence Council advises the US president on long-term challenges facing American foreign policy. And now it's produced a report for Barack Obama. Our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, has the details.
Well, it makes for rather sober reading for Barack Obama when he comes into the White House in January. It depicts a world in which the US is no longer the sole superpower able to call the shots more or less alone. It says that world is now gone. It's a multipolar world with much more uncertainty for the US and for everyone involved. A world in which resources are more scarce, so more likely to be conflicts between states over resources, and where states in some parts of the world are beginning to collapse, and what they call non-state actors, which can be criminal gangs, terrorist groups, and so on, begin to rise to take over power in more fragmented states. So it's really a picture of fragmentation, more uncertainty, and greater potential conflict over scarcer resources.
Are the world's international institutions able to cope with these challenges?
Not according to this report. This is one of the warnings of the report. It says that the international institutions, as they are at the moment, cooked up as they were in the aftermath of the Second World War, are not up to the job. And without real leadership and real reorganization, they won't be up to the job in brokering these conflicts over resources and these conflicts, potential conflicts between states and all these non-state actors.
Do we have any idea of how Barack Obama might approach these challenges?
Well, all the mood music and everything he's said about foreign policy up to now has suggested that he's going to take a far more multilateral approach than his predecessor. He seems to be aware that this unipolar moment, this American moment following the end of the Cold War, is over, and that if America wants to achieve anything, it'll have to achieve it in concert, not necessarily with, you know, its traditional allies, but untraditional allies and partners, and also outside the traditional boundaries of the international organizations like the UN, creating sort of networks of states with similar interests to try and get particular things done.
Julian Borgia. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.